Welcome to another episode of Congo Kids Life Stories, where I share my experiences of growing up in the Congo in Central Africa. My hope is you find knowledge, entertainment, information, and insight of another culture and a new perspective of the Congolese people and Africa. Welcome back to the series about the history of the establishment of the Evangelical Free Church mission work in the northwest corner of Congo in the Ubangi region. As previously mentioned, the Free Church was started in 1884 when 22 churches, comprised mainly by Swedish immigrants with similar beliefs of church government and biblical doctrines, agreed to cooperate to support home and foreign missions. The goal of the mission effort was to share the gospel, particularly to the Congolese, to start churches, train up leaders, and to have the autonomous church continue on their own. I decided to do this series on the history of the Free Church mission work because my family was part of the effort for 25 years in the 1960s through 1990. Many of the events in this series involved me and my parents. Much of the early work had helped establish a functioning mission, but much happened during my family's tenure, so I felt that sharing the journey from the beginning, as well as the stories of all those that passed away during the effort, was important. Furthermore, there is a lot of information and history that will be shared that has never been heard or documented, and I'm glad to have captured it to preserve it for future generations. This is episode 4 of 7. The first episode told the story of the Free Church mission work starting in the early 1920s, led by the vision of Titus Johnson. The work faced considerable challenges in its infancy to have established 3 mission stations by 1936. Several people were laid to rest. The second episode covered adding more mission stations from 1936 to 1947, and several more people being buried in Congo. Episode 3 covered several more mission stations being located and started, as well as a child and adult that died in the 1948 to 1952 period. This fourth episode looks at the period of 1953 to 1962. 4 more mission stations were started, and regretfully, 1 adult and 2 children were laid to rest as well. The baton pass from the missionaries to the Congolese church started to occur about this time, and the push for the church to become autonomous began. And the dilemma of educating all the children of the missionaries is addressed. So let's get started with episode 4.
And how can anyone preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Romans 10:15.
In 1953, the Free Church was asked to take over the station at Gwenji that belonged to the Congo Balolo Mission. This mission organization had been operating in Congo since the late 1800s, but they decided to focus on other areas near the capital and in central Congo and offered the station to the Free Church. Gwenji was located south of Gemena and not too far from Bujala, a government post. A year later, when the influx of new missionaries was assured to staff it, the Free Church Field Council approved the request. On May 29, 1955, the mission station was transferred. The mission station infrastructure needed improvement, so the mission allocated funds for refurbishment. In January 1956, the Merle Wester family and Moreau Sholin family moved to Gwenji. I've asked Dr. Tim Wester, who lived at Gwenji for 7 years as a young child and grew up in Congo, later returning as a career missionary doctor, to share a few memories of Gwenji. What was the topography like?
It was pretty flat, and it was mainly jungle, virgin jungle.
Tim describes the mission station campus.
Yeah, Gwenji was about 7 kilometers from Bujala, and as you came up the lane, the first buildings to the left were the primary school that Lee Higo built. And then there was 3 missionary dwellings. Naomi Skoglund was at kind of like, I think it was 1-bedroom, kind of as a singles house. And then there was a 3rd missionary house that had 2 or 3 bedrooms. Off to the right was the girls' school. And actually between the girls' school and the mission, they actually put the airplane strip right down, basically right in the center of the mission station. And if you would have kept going at the end of the airstrip, you hit the church. Then beyond the church was the dispensary off to the right, school teachers' homes that were probably the next 100 to 200 yards. And farther down that road is where they got sand and the water source.
The water source was a stream located down the hill, but much of the domestic water was captured by rain gutters and stored in cisterns. Tim describes the main focus of the Gwenji station.
It was mainly a church planting outpost. It eventually had a dispensary, and 20 years later, a Bible school was established there.
Tim was a youngster during his years at Gwenji, but his experience left him with many lifelong memories.
I mean, this was where we first grew up and spent the first part of our life. So a lot of memories as kids playing in the sand. It was kind of a sandy region, forest area. We had monkeys behind our house. We had elephants that came to the gardens right next door. So it was very tropical. I think because it was a small station, we felt very connected to the people. The people were well known for their singing. And so that was pretty well known throughout the Seikyu as far as their ability to carry on songs and stuff like that. It was where we learned how to eat African food, ride a bike, play with the African kids, shoot our slingshots, do a variety of things. So it was kind of the early part of our memory. And
Gwenji continued to have missionaries into the 1980s, though often only one family was located there. As missionaries continued to come to Congo, and many were families, the need to educate the children was indeed becoming a more pressing issue. There were resources being used from a school in Gemena, but it used a Belgian system of education, nor was it a Christian school. It was considered very good, and there were great teachers. The concern of the missionary kids returning to the States for furlough and being faced with both the general culture shock, but also a completely different type of schooling, needed to be figured out. So discussions and dialogue began on what to do. This became a hot issue amongst the field missionaries in 1953, with meetings and disagreements as to sticking with the Gemena school or push forward with the Ubangi Academy. Votes split down denominational lines, and then arguments ensued as to funding and money for building a campus. Eventually, an agreement of cooperation was reached. And in 1957, the collective decision was to keep the Ubangi Academy as it was and have both missions embrace this educational system for the children. They also added 11th and 12th grade, which then allowed kids to complete high school there. A few short years later, Congo achieved independence. And after things settled down, the Gemena school changed completely and wasn't worth much in terms of a quality education. So God, wisdom, or foresight prevailed that sticking with the Ubangi Academy model was the best decision for the Free Church and Covenant missionaries. Elaine Peterson came in 1956 as a teacher. Miss Peterson was also my teacher for my junior high and senior high years at UBOC in the 1970s. She taught several courses, but was the French teacher primarily. She taught until retirement. They finished building the school classrooms and the dormitory in 1957. The dorm building was 240 feet long, with two halls on each end, and the living room, dining room, and kitchen in the middle. There were 9 rooms per hall, with a common bathroom. Boys were on one end, and girls on the other end. Each room had 2 twin beds, a built-in dresser and closet, and had a window. At the end of each hall, there was an apartment suite that had 2 rooms and a bathroom. A small living area for the dorm parents was in one hall. Behind the dorm structure was a breezeway for washing dishes, a cookhouse, and a laundry room. The campus also had a tennis court and basketball court, a wood shop, chicken coop, and light plant building. There was a patio and fireplace out front. There was also a small soccer field and a full-size soccer field. The medical needs continued at Tandala, and construction was underway for the permanent facility. The hospital was seeing patients all during construction and the finishing work. In 1954, records indicated that there were 8,520 cases. They conducted 69,449 consultations, performed 427 operations, and delivered 114 babies. And finally, on May 17, 1955, the Tandala Hospital's dedication service was held. There were 6,000 people in attendance to celebrate this new medical facility. When the medical facility was almost finished, John Campbell wrote to the Beacon magazine, sharing the burden of his heart.
Our constant burden is that this aspect of the overall mission program will be a means of winning Africans for the Lord Jesus.
That has been the goal of everyone associated with the hospital at that time and since, with very few exceptions. The logbook for that day carries an exciting account of the event.
A red-letter day in our mission. That for which we had prayed for so long now was a reality. It was a beautiful day. At the hospital grounds, benches had been set up with palm branches for shelter. There was a platform with loudspeakers. At first, there was a parade of school children of the region and the station, the Bible Institute students, and so on. Each school had a banner with the name of the school. There were drummers and flag bearers. In all, approximately 2,000 people took part in the parade. It was very impressive.
The Belgian administrator for the territory of Gemena came over and spoke. Molly Hansen, Esther London, and Dr. Arnold T. Olson had come out from the States for the dedication of the hospital. Probably the happiest people on the grounds that day were Dr. John and Mary Lou Campbell and the nurses who would be helping them. They not only were serving God in a needy pagan land, but for the first time since the work began, they had the adequate facilities to work with. They would be able to take care of their patients in clean, comfortable surroundings. The nurses would not be involved with the horrendous problems involved in caring for patients like those Elizabeth Anderson had endured when she assisted Dr. Titus Johnson the first time he operated on patients at Tandala. As the medical personnel stood there watching the events, no doubt their thought went beyond practicing medicine, important as that was. They surely considered the patients who would be coming in to Tandala for medical treatment, along with their relatives and friends, as was the custom of the Africans. What an opportunity they would have to share Christ with those who had never heard. Dr. Titus Johnson, who was back in America at that time, sent a letter expressing his own happiness that the hospital was now a reality.
My dear co-laborers and friends in the Ubangi, the 17th of May is but a few nights away. This is the day above any other day that I would have liked to be present at Tandala to celebrate such a unique occasion as the dedication of the hospital. A dream has come true. My thoughts and prayers are with you in this culminating hour of completion and accomplishment after 30 years of mission enterprise in the Ubangi. It is a testimony and a monument to God's faithfulness. He has provided in a marvelous way, and it is a testimony to the unfailing loyalty of the men and women who have, throughout the years, dedicated their time and their lives to His service in the Ubangi. That has not been done without sacrifice. They have served the Master unselfishly in that far-flung corner of the world. It is also our open declaration that we have not forgotten any part of our Master's command. He has told us to preach the gospel and heal the sick, and to help the helpless. I regret that I cannot be with you today in person to share with you the joys this brings. But let these lines assure you of my profound esteem for a work well done by all. There has been a cementing unity in purpose. Even though there have been both hard and dark days, yet with determination and faith and hope for a new day of increased service within the Ubangi of the Belgian Congo. We long to see a Christian Ubangi with a strong Christian church that will stand and grow and carry on in the spirit in which it was founded. Long after we as molders have returned to our own land and shores, staunch believers equal in faith to ourselves will be standing here, carrying on the work. They will be an everlasting living tribute to our labor in love in past times. We also must thank the best and honorable and loyal citizens of the colony to which we owe so much for the liberty and cooperation they have accorded us in our efforts to serve our master and fellow men. To all of you, I extend my sincere and cordial greetings, wishing all of you God's richest blessing and congratulations. Titus W. Johnson.
A few days after the dedication, the missionaries met and passed a resolution that thanked God for Dr. Titus Johnson and for his leadership and guidance and vision. They also asked the Overseas Mission Board to name the hospital the Titus Johnson Hospital because of the all-important part he played in bringing it to reality. Today, a visitor, hearing the name of the hospital and asking about it, gives his host opportunity to share a little of what Dr. Titus did to start the Free Church work in the Ubangi and to get the hospital built. It is a tribute to a worthy individual. Thelma Landrude was a missionary nurse that served in Congo for 40 years, of which 30 were stationed at Tandala. I've asked her to provide some additional color about the mission station called Tandala. What was the topography like?
We're on the top of a hill, which seems to be a trait of a lot of mission stations. There are forests around, and there is grassland around Tandala.
So describe the mission station.
We had a big station compared to a lot of the others because it was our medical work. We had the hospital, which included a clinic and the maternity and a nursing school. There was the church. There were a lot of schools. We had a Bible school, we had primary school, secondary school, and there were staff housing for almost all of those places.
Being a nurse, Thelma was very involved with the operations of the hospital and elaborates on the medical side of Tandala.
It was around 200 beds at the maximum time, and it's a little different than when you think of at home because all of the wards were open to the out-of-doors, and so people were in and out all the time. And a lot of the work was actually done by patients' families. The medical care is quite different than here in the States. You come to the hospital with family members who will help take care of you, and that means cooking food, etc., because we don't provide the meals. A lot of surgeries were done. And so you had a medical ward, and then you had surgical wards. And all of the staff was trained at Tandala. And we followed the government rules, and we were accredited by the government so that our students were following along with the government requirements. It started out with nurses' aides, and then they worked up to practical nurses that we would have here in the States, and eventually they had university degrees at the end.
Water for the homes and hospital and the general populace was a big challenge.
Most of the water was carried from the local watering hole by women. Eventually, we had cisterns that got the rainwater off the roofs of the buildings during the rainy season. During dry season, it pretty much dried up. There was even times when we had to truck water into the hospital because we didn't have enough. And so water has been a problem and continues to be a problem. Currently, we have some wells that have been dug, but they never provide quite enough water for all the people that are there.
So Thelma, after working 30 years at Tandala, what made it special to you?
We were a small community and a large family. As single gals, we were included in everything that the families did. We depended on each other for everything. We worked together, we played together, we prayed together. We shared our joys, we shared our sorrows, and we made friendships that have lasted through my whole life, and close friendships. Some of my closest friends are the people that I know from Tandala days.
As time went on, American doctors and nurses were replaced with Congolese doctors and nurses, and fully so after the 1997 evacuation. The Free Church in the U.S. continues to support the hospital from afar by raising funds for special projects and helping with medical supplies. The Tondela Mission Station still focuses on education and the medical ministry in the area. Recall that the Bible Institute of the Ubangi, with the acronym IBU, at Tondela, was started in 1949. By the early 1950s, it was operating fine. However, in 1953, the mission boards began to discuss proposed plans for relocation. They knew it would be a challenging and costly relocation, but there were three key reasons to consider this. First, Tondela was getting crowded, causing some health issues. Second, the campus was getting full and expansion opportunities were limited. The Tondela Hospital was being built and would soon dominate the station as a regional medical center. And third, the gardens that supplied the food for the station and villages were not the best. The next year, the 1954 MEU conference voted to, quote, that a new location be sought for the IBU on a neutral location, unquote. Dr. Arnold T. Olson was asked to evaluate the matter and report his findings when he came to visit Congo in 1955. He concluded that moving the Bible Institute was a good decision, and they decided Goyongo would be the right place. They put a budget together, and the legal representative applied for the land. The boundaries were cleared early in 1957 so that the state official might see the exact location of the land requested. The request was for 98 hectares, which is approximately 250 acres, for the school. That request was rejected. They reapplied for 34 hectares, or about 85 acres, and after months of negotiation, that site was approved. So in 1958, construction got underway for the school. The school would have two prongs. The first was for the student that could read and write and had some education, but couldn't handle more difficult courses. The second level was for those that could master more difficult courses but couldn't qualify for a seminary level. The mission realized the need for trained pastors to serve all the churches in the area. They also looked ahead to have the IBU be a stepping stone for seminary training. I've asked John Lundquist, who grew up at Goyongo from the early 1960s till the mid-1970s, to explain the Bible school.
So the purpose of the school was to train pastors and their wives for them to be pastors and pastors' wives in villages throughout the Ubangi Mongala area. And as the school progressed through the years, they slowly raised the educational level of the instruction as they had people with increased educational level available to come there. The classes were probably about 10 to 12 students, if I remember right. I think at first it was 3 years, and then by the time I graduated from high school in 1974, I'm pretty sure it was a four-year program. And there were usually two or three missionary professors. At one point, there were four. There were usually two African professors, and the director was African. In addition to the classroom work, they also took the students out on practical work in the villages, doing preaching and learning how to plant churches. And I think they may also have had internships.
The station was built in a very forested area with considerable jungle and old growth trees.
The thing that really struck me and that strikes me about it was its immense beauty. This place had a combination of hills and tall forest. It was literally cut out of the forest. And it was in the early years, especially, we were surrounded by wildlife. Chimpanzees played or whatever in our backyard at night. I remember waking up and seeing monkeys up in the trees out of my bedroom window. And the edge of the forest was literally 10 to 15 feet from my bedroom window. Practically every morning we would wake up and there would be hornbills, giant hornbills, and blue-crested turicos and green pigeons flying around in the trees. It was just spectacular beauty all over the place.
John also told me about how many poisonous snakes, mambas, and cobras there were at Goyongo, with many close calls for being bitten. thanks to the Lundquist dog, Flicka, for preventing a few deadly tragedies. Also, tarantulas were all over the place, and one person was bitten and nearly died. The mission station was rather remote from the other mission stations.
This school location was chosen for its isolation, and for the missionaries who were there, this was a culturally and physically really isolated station. You didn't want to end up needing medical help in an emergency way if you were there.
Two of the houses were very small. Extremely small is a better description. Another house was only slightly bigger. John believes it had to do with finances. Jack Dangers, the builder, felt the super small houses were not appropriate to serve the basic needs of the families. Jack poured a larger foundation than called for on the plans for the next house. He was very creative in modifying the building materials, including mixing cement with clay and using rough lumber and sawing it on site to stretch the money in order to finish the house. One thing that John expressed to me was the quality and craftsmanship of the houses that Jack Dangers built. Also, the chapel is gorgeous in both the exterior, architectural, and finishes. Jack had a great eye for curb appeal and aesthetics. John describes the school campus and the mission station compound.
There were four missionary houses up the side of this little hill. The two at the top were tiny. The next one down was substantially bigger, still small, and the next one below that was, it was tiny, but not as tiny as the two at the top. And it had, for a while, it had a swimming pool that was built by Byron Seashore. The mission station was a school campus. That's all it was, with support facilities. And there was one Bible school and four missionary professor houses, or missionary houses, which were almost always used by professors. There were two African professor houses. There was a beautiful A-frame chapel. And there was a student dorm area, along with a few houses for African staff who helped keep the mission running.
Their water supply came from a stream way up the hill, about a 30-minute hike. There, Jack Dangers made a cement box to capture the water and ran a 1-inch pipe down to the mission station where the water filled 55-gallon barrels and then was fed to the school, teachers' homes, and missionary homes. In 1967, Byron Seashore decided to cement in a small area by the third larger house and make a swimming pool and patio area. This was enjoyed for about 3 years until it began to deteriorate. One thing I remember was from 1968 when the missions conference was held there. One of the evenings was fun night, and this involved skits and talents being shared. A memory from when I was 5 years old was Jack Lashbaugh was doing a skit. Jack was a super fun guy, and he was playing a doctor. I think Byron Seashore was the patient on the operating table. As the skit progressed, and quote, doctor, unquote, Jack, was trying to diagnose the patient's illness, he declared it was cancer. Then, Dr. Jack began pulling a long string that had cans tied to it from underneath the sheet covering the patient. The crowd hooted with the storyline and the antics. I, however, didn't know what cancer was, and was horrified at seeing a long string with 10 soup cans tied to it coming out of the patient and clanging on the ground. I literally thought Uncle Byron was going to die. It was many years later that I understood it was just a skit and that cancer was a disease. So I was able to get past that horrible memory of Uncle Byron allegedly dying from cancer, represented by cans and string. I'll never forget Uncle Jack Lashbaugh that night either. But on a more serious note, John relates to what made Goyongo special to him.
I'm going to start with the spiritual atmosphere. Goyongo was different from any other missionary station atmosphere I encountered. During my time there, most of the missionary professors were passionate about prayer and devotional life. And so was the director of the school, Professor Doko, who is the president of the church, and Professor Ngutwa, the only African professor I remember from that period. And they would have prayer meetings almost every afternoon for like an hour. And in addition to this, I think all of them had their own personal devotions whenever in the day. And then they were teaching from the Bible. So that was the bulk of the classroom education. And there were chapel services. And the students were there. It was kind of like being at a Bible camp, except that instead of kids and young adult counselors, you had people who were really serious about being Christian. And it affected the spiritual atmosphere of that whole mission station. It was a lovely place to be at in that regard.
So Goyongo was a unique mission station in many ways, as John explained. The Bible Institute operated for many years and became a key part of the training effort for numerous pastors and ministry workers in the Ubangi region. Clyde Raymond Carlson was born and raised in Escanaba, Michigan. He grew up in a Christian family, but not until he was 17 did he fully embrace his Christian faith. After high school, he moved to Chicago and attended Moody Bible Institute, then North Park College and North Park Seminary. In a letter he wrote, he documented that it was one night, alone in his room at North Park College, that God spoke to him and he dedicated his life to work in Africa. After graduation in 1949, he was ordained. He was accepted by the Covenant Mission Board to serve in Congo. After 8 months in Belgium to learn French, in June 1950, he arrived on the mission field. His first term, he was stationed at Gbado. He was working as a pastor evangelist. Documentation I reviewed indicated his love for teaching and preaching in the villages. He mastered Lingala in order to better communicate with the villagers. In addition, he also wrote that his most satisfying achievement was helping start the Bible school at Bado. This makes sense, as he later wrote that his biggest burden and concern for his ministry was the training of competent village teachers for the growth of the church. Halfway through his second term, he moved to Karawa to continue his ministry. There, he provided leadership to 43 pastors and workers, overseeing 59 churches in several districts. He was known as a tall, good-looking man, and he never married. Though I heard from multiple people that many tried to set him up with some of the single ladies on the mission field. He was very approachable and loved by all. He also loved children. Bruce Dennis was stationed at Bado as a young boy and remembers Clyde always giving them candy from a metal box whenever they asked. Bruce remembers Clyde as a kind soul to everyone. David Lundblad was a young boy at the time as well and remembers Clyde as his neighbor.
Well, Clyde was always a special uncle, I think, for all of us. You know, he was the only time that I was ever aware that we had a single missionary man. And Clyde, of course, was, a tall, good-looking Scandinavian fellow. You couldn't exist as a single person. You had to get married. So, they were trying, whether it was Kay Sunstrand or different single women, trying to connect him up with Clyde. But, of course, he never did get married. But he lived in the house that is, I think it was called Middle. You know, every place there had a name. And Middle is exactly the place where I was born back in 42. So it was interesting. And we lived in a house immediately adjacent to that.
Clyde was known for spending time with the kids at Karawa and giving them rides on his motorcycle sidecar.
He had a motorcycle. He would give us rides, but of course everybody wanted to do the same thing.
Once he crammed 5 kids on his motorcycle. The kids loved it. Clyde also loved to hunt, a big carryover from his youth in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, where he'd been a big hunter. He was also known as a principled man. He didn't care for petty politics, but rather building fellowship with the other missionaries and Congolese, with his goal of being building the Church of Jesus Christ. When energy and words deviated from this goal, he sternly reminded his co-workers to not forget the purpose of their work. In early July 1957, Clyde became ill. His health continued to fail over the next 10 days or so, and this resulted in several doctors and nurses tending to him. He was being cared for in a house, and David Lundblad, an 8-year-old boy at the time, remembers he was under an oxygen tent of sorts.
My last memory of Clyde is he was under an oxygen tent, and he, you know, lived right next door to us.
The seriousness was real, such that the missionaries held their annual conference at Tondala with all attending, save Dr. Wally Thornbloom and two nurses that stayed at Karawa to look after Clyde. The next day, July 25th, the radio report from Karawa was that Clyde seemed to be doing better. That was good news. The next evening, however, the radio message from Sarah Thornbloom at Karawa was,
"Clyde is very sick. Not much hope. Clyde is very sick. Not much hope."
Immediately, two other doctors and a few others jumped in a truck to beeline it to Karawa. They arranged a 10:30 p.m. radio communication when they arrived. A storm was raging, so that the radio connection was difficult to hear, but everyone huddled around the radio. Then Art Lundblad's voice came through the speaker.
"Clyde went to be with the Lord at 6 o'clock tonight."
Everyone at Tondala stood quietly. Some wiped their eyes. It was a dramatic moment for everyone. It was July 26th, 1957. Clyde was 37 years old. The law required burial within 24 hours, so the two groups made some plans via the radio that night. Needless to say, the conference was cut short, and the remaining Tondala folks left for Karawa the next morning, arriving around noon. A carpenter was up all night building the coffin. That afternoon, the drums beat, announcing the service at the church. Eleven 1,100 people filled the church to overflowing. A storm started to brew, but nobody moved or left the service. Several missionaries and a Congolese pastor spoke at the service. The last song was Clyde's favorite.
"I found a friend, oh, such a friend. He loved me ere I knew him. He drew me with the cords of love, and thus he bound me to him."
Pallbearers were three missionaries and three of Clyde's Congolese friends. They put the coffin in the truck to transport it to the cemetery. The rain started, then it started to pour. The group was soaked, so stopped for cover. They decided to hold the interment service on the porch of a building as it was getting dark. Then, when the rain stopped, the group proceeded to the cemetery where the coffin was lowered. So the 12th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Clyde Carlson.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
He is believed to have suffered from what was described as a heart-liver ailment. But nothing was definitive from my research. His home church in Escanaba, Michigan, held a memorial service for Clyde on August 2nd. Reverend Ralph Hansen, Secretary of the Covenant World Missions, was the speaker at the service. A memorial fund was set up, and the Bible school building at Bado was built in honor of his life and work. Dr. Arden Almquist and his wife Joanne first went to Congo in 1951. With two children already, Arden and Joanne were excited for the arrival of their third child. They were at Karawa to be where the hospital was. Unfortunately, Joanne endured a challenging delivery of their son, Timothy Arden Almquist. Alden Almquist, also known as Aldi, the son of Arden and Joanne, who was 7 years old at the time, recounts the event.
"Tim was long anticipated, and my parents left Kwasola for Karawa for the delivery. My first inkling that something had gone wrong was being taken out of school by missionary uncle, walking from the mission through the little patch of jungle to Carroll Hospital, and uncle telling me that everything had not gone right in Tim Salisbury. So I then got to the guest house. Dad took me by the hand. I saw Mom in the hospital bed looking very weak. And Dad explained to me what went wrong with the delivery. And I remember asking to see Tim's body, and Dad trying to dissuade me. He said, but then he assented and began to see the body, which was good for me. It made it all real. And I think my strongest memories, being taken out of the dorm to live with my parents at the guest house, that was strange. I remember there was a lot of pain, the pain of grief. I remember people's kind words, but that not helping much. I remember climbing a favorite tree in that little jamba, that jungle stretch between the mission and the dorm. I remember sitting on a branch and singing my heart out. That helped. Singing the old hymns. Why should I be anxious? I have such a friend. Rock of Ages, cleft for me. Others. And I felt better when I climbed back down.
He explains the cause of Timothy's passing.
The umbilical cord had wrapped around the neck. Dad told me back in the States, it would have been a better outcome, but that was the news.
It was May 5th, 1958. The funeral was the next day.
Tim's funeral service, which I still remember vividly. There was the UBAC choir of my classmates. I, of course, was in the audience. I remember fighting the tears when the choir sang that old timeless Swedish hymn, Children of the Heavenly Father. That hymn contains a lyrical promise of God's eternal presence, you know, in the face of death, whenever, wherever. And there was one verse, though he giveth and he taketh, God his children ne'er forsaketh, that I memorized on that day. Oh, I've never forgotten it. And it soothed my child's soul. It was true comfort being sung. And that hymn had always been a favorite of mine. And I promised myself that in Tim's memory, I would never sing it again in its entirety for the rest of my life. And it's a promise that I shared with no one, and a promise that I've kept to this day.
Little Timothy was buried at Carowa. So the 13th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Timothy Arden Almquist.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
Support was tremendous. Aldi explains.
It's one of the reasons I got interested in anthropology, how you make sense of the way other people deal with death. It was so powerful. We got back to the mission, and I remember people coming up to our front door on our return, shaking Dad's hand and just announcing, I have come to sit with you, end quote. That's it. No welcome back, doctor. I'm so sorry. No verbiage. I have come to sit with you, full stop. And that's just what they did. The house was packed full of sitting bodies. And Dad first tried to talk a little with some of those mourners, but he didn't get any reply. Eventually he got it, because talk was the Western way. And the African's way was the gift, you know, not of soothing words, but of soothing presence. It did feel a little eerie to have scores of people sitting jammed in every corner of our house. But eventually, you know, it was comforting. It was comforting to have them there. They were there maybe two and a half hours, and then they'd stand up and shake Dad's hand and go home. No words.
It should be noted that American culture involves offering condolences and words of support and encouragement when a friend or relative passes away. In Congo, the concept of presence is how support and sharing in grief is manifested. During this time in Congo, the infant mortality rate was nearly 50% of children not making it to 5 years of age. So while this was a tragic loss for the Almquist family, Dr. Almquist, as written in his book, felt that this event showed the humanity of the white man vis-a-vis the Congolese. This was during the colonial rule of Belgium, and there was a large gap between the natives and the Belgians and Americans in terms of perception and rank in society. This showed the Congolese that even an infant's death can happen to a missionary doctor.
Ultimately, Tim's death brought our family closer to the Africans than we've been before, because the story you just told, you know, a guy told Dad, yeah, in the village we give birth many times, but many babies die at birth or a little after. While the white babies, when they're born, they always come out and they live. So seeing the mission doctor, his all-powerful mission doctor, lose a child made him realize that we whites were in our shared vulnerability to death, just like they were. We were one after all. So it brought us closer, much closer to the Congolese. It was, in that sense, a blessing. We became real. We weren't angels from on high telling them all about Jesus and immune to all the pains and travails. We were in that with them.
Shortly after the loss, Dr. Almquist wrote a long poem to commemorate his son and deal with the grief. It can be found in his book he later penned called Debtors Unashamed. The loss of Timothy impacted the family.
It was not a huge tragedy because he had not had time to live. He was a promise, and the promise didn't happen. But we did not go through a long period of trauma. Several years later, Kathy was born. So it wasn't the end of our family growth.
The Almquist continued to serve in Congo until 1960, when they evacuated at Independence. It was the next year that their fourth child, Kathy, was born. Arden then served for a seven-year period as Executive Secretary of World Missions for the Covenant Mission in the early 1960s. They returned to Loko in Congo with the Paul Carlson Foundation, where Arden ran the hospital until health issues caused them to return to the U.S. in 1977. Dr. Almquist later held administrative positions at a hospital, was a pastor in Kansas for a period, and then was the director of the Christian Medical Society in the early 1980s. Both Arden and Joanne continued to work and serve until their passing in 2002 and 1993, respectively. Dr. Titus spent the next 5 years, from 1955 to 1960, in Chicago, rebuilding his practice and his finances. Yet, after spending an adventurous 14 months in Congo, accepting the reality of the divorce, and recognizing his heart was in Congo, this resulted in this half-decade of not really fitting in to the former Chicago scene as he'd done before. Unsure of his status as a non-missionary due to his divorce, he felt that no mission would hire him and his service to the Congolese was over. All these items weighed on him, yet he yearned for the adventure and informality of Africa. Furthermore, the practice of medicine in Chicago was dull compared to the unique cases, frantic pace, and challenges of surgeries in Congo. In the fall of 1959, he was urged by Dr. Wally Thornbloom to visit Congo so the people there could minister to him, as Dr. Thornbloom was aware of Dr. Titus's depression. A few weeks after his arrival at Karawa, he received an invitation from the Swedish Covenant Church to serve in their mission in Lower Congo. He accepted, and in April 1960, gave up his medical practice in Chicago and returned to Congo. This time he went to Kibunzi, located between Leopoldville and the port of Matadi on the Atlantic coast. That year was full of adventure, surgeries, being held captive by soldiers angry at the white man, and other challenges. Independence from Belgian colonial rule occurred on June 30, 1960, so there was animosity against anybody white. He returned to Chicago in September 1961. Then, in November, he suffered a heart attack. He spent 2 months in the hospital and another month recuperating. His doctor forbade him from practicing medicine again. Then, in May 1962, heart attack number 2 hit. Now the message was clear. he must give up his medical practice. So he sold it. However, another Swedish mission reached out in 1964 asking him to help provide medical coverage in Tanzania for a few months. So in March, he was on site at Nkinga, Tanzania. Though his body called for rest and recuperation due to his heart attacks, his spirit needed to be called, to be needed, and to serve. He spent 13 months. Then he left for Karawa and was there for a few months. Of interest, my family arrived at Karawa the first week of October 1965. Dr. Titus was there for a few weeks before leaving for Pinga in eastern Congo in the mountains. No doubt our paths crossed, but as a child of 3 years of age, I wouldn't have remembered that. He settled in Pinga, and there he continued to do medical work, ignoring his weakened heart. Furthermore, he finally built his permanent home. Of course, he built a swimming pool, landscaped the yard, and devoted time to his gardening and nurturing the plants and flowers he procured on his travels. By the mid-1950s, the mission was recognizing the need to start work in urban cities. They identified several options, one being Bumba. Bumba was located on the Congo River, way south of everything, and even beyond Lisala. It was 250-plus miles away, so a solid day-and-a-half truck trip from Karawa. In 1958, Chet and Jean Larson, along with a Congolese pastor, were sent to Bumba to start their work there. They started a primary school. Then, recognizing that they needed to establish a permanent ministry, Carl, a.k.a. Cully, and Vivian Edstrom were sent there. Cully was a builder who was tasked to build a church, a pastor's house, and primary school buildings. Vivian worked with the women in various capacities. The construction projects were nearly complete in August 1964 when Simba rebels started to approach the area, so the Edstrom family fled to Karawa for safety, only about 10 hours ahead of the rebel forces. For a detailed story of this incident, I urge you to listen to episode 19 on my podcast. I've asked Dan Noren, who lived there in the early 1970s for several years, to describe the mission station.
Yeah, it was a unique place. The mission station at Bumba was just our house. It was an old colonial mansion, obviously going back to the Belgian Congo, right? And some kind of fancy Belgian people lived in that house. It had 14-foot ceilings, huge porch kind of thing overlooking the Congo River, a number of massive rooms. Our bedrooms were as big as my house, huge bedrooms. And then Aunt Kay Sunstrand was always with us in the little annex right next door. But that's all it was. It was that annex, our big monstrous house, our Lopango that was probably a good 2 acres, and then you had to go about 3 miles over to the church, you know.
Dan describes the topography.
The river, of course, was the artery for all the merchandise, business going up and down the river. That was a place of life, right? All the merchandise came in there and all the fishermen were out there. It was always a lively place to just sit on the porch and watch. Of course, we fished in the river. I went out in the canoe in the river with my African friends, and it was a big part of our life in Bumba, the Congo River, right in front of you there, yep.
So what was the ministry focus of Bumba?
So it was establishing the Covenant Church in the area there, you know, supporting the African church, and basically just, evangelism was the primary focus. And Aunt Kay Sunstrand, under her leadership, we turned a bar, downtown Bumba, we turned a bar into a place called the Monyama, which was the fishnet. There were ping pong tables there and lemonade and stuff to drink. My brother and I would go out there and play ping pong with the kids at night, you know, and they'd come in and they had Christian music playing in there, and Aunt Kay would play her accordion, old hymns, you know. So it was called the Monyama, the net, right in the downtown in the Cité. We're surrounded by all kinds of bars, and it was a community center for outreach. Yep, that was Kay Sunstrand's idea, and she was really good at that. She had women's groups there too, you know, teaching them how to sew and hygiene, and they had a place to take care of the kids, and it was a really, really good thing she developed there.
Even though situated on the edge of the mighty Congo River, how did they get water for the homes?
We had running water from the city. We had electricity from the city.
Here are a few memories from Dan.
We had French bread every day. My brother and I would jump on the Yamaha 100 and drive down to the bakery. They had a bakery. We'd get French bread, baguettes, bring them back, and we had butter. The Greek merchants there had butter. There was culture there. There was French culture there that we didn't really have up at Ubangi Academy. And then there were Portuguese kids there too. And we had a good friend. One of them was Rafael. And we spoke Lingala with him. He'd come by and we'd go hunting with him and stuff. Great guy. And he had some older brothers. We had Portuguese friends there that we spoke Lingala with. Oh, there were some Chinese people there too that were in agriculture development. One of them brought me a watermelon one day. He grew a watermelon. How he ever did that, I don't know. So we had Chinese, we had Portuguese. It was very culturally diverse.
Bumba continued to be a location for the Covenant Church, though it was very distant from the other stations. The station only had one family and possibly a single person living there over the years, and toward the 1980s and 1990s, no missionary staff was living there full-time, as the local church continued on with its work. By the late 1950s, there were stirrings and the Congolese leaders that began talk of independence. Patrice Lumumba was one such leader activist, as well as Joseph Kasavubu. Civil unrest started to occur in 1959 against the Belgian regime and some of the Belgian colonizers. At one such event in early 1960, a rally for independence was held and soldiers went to quash it, resulting in many people being killed or wounded. This further agitated the populace and created unrest, primarily in Leopoldville, the capital. Meanwhile, numerous other African colonies were seeking and getting independence from their colonizing mother countries. A big meeting was held in Brussels, Belgium, early in 1960, with both Belgian and Congolese leaders. They agreed to grant independence to the Congolese on June 30, 1960, a mere 4 months away. This wasn't nearly enough time to plan a transition or handle the affairs needed for a smooth change in government and leadership. But this is what the Congolese wanted. And they got what they wanted. A huge countrywide party ensued, but the next week the army revolted, causing all sorts of issues. Lawlessness prevailed, and at the direction of the U.S. Embassy, Americans were told to leave. Though our mission work was many miles away in the northwest corner of the country, far from the mayhem in the capital, Leopoldville, all the missionaries left and crossed over to Central African Republic. Some families returned to the U.S., and others sent the wives and children back to the States until things cooled down, leaving the men in Central African Republic. Many of the missionary men would cross into Congo to help with the work there for a period, then return across the border. For some men, they were apart from their families for a full year, as they wanted to continue the work and ensure its survival. The country itself fell into economic chaos those first few years of independence. Seeing the instability and threat to their safety, most of the Belgian or Portuguese merchants and businessmen left. With their departure, they took their talents, systems, and money. Thriving businesses and plantations that provided jobs, taxes, and infrastructure to the economy ceased, as the local Congolese didn't have the training, education, or banking relationships. So functioning businesses were looted or run into the ground. Then, throw in more craziness, like several provinces seceding from the country, thus drawing in the United Nations to help restore order. Or Patrice Lumumba, the prime minister, being captured and executed. The politics were a mess. The country was a mess. By 1961, enough stability had returned to the country, so the missionaries and their families returned to their stations and picked up where they'd left off a year prior. Dr. Warren Berggren, a Free Church missionary, and his wife, Dr. Gretchen Berggren, went to the then Belgian Congo in 1959. Part of their time was spent at Libengi and Kala. The next year, Dr. Gretchen became pregnant with their first child. All seemed fine during their pregnancy. They went to Libengi as there was a hospital there. Unfortunately, upon delivery, the baby was stillborn. The date was April 22, 1961. Dr. Gretchen shares about the burial.
The missionaries at Kala helped us with the burial. I had just given birth. The baby was stillborn. And the missionaries blessed the child and gave him a nice burial.
There was tremendous support from both the missionaries and the Congolese after this loss.
There was not an official service, but we were surrounded by loving care of missionaries and the loving care of Congolese. Damon sat by my bed after the baby was stillborn.
When I asked Dr. Gretchen about how the family coped with the loss and how they moved forward, she shared that they moved past the pain and loss in due time, but chose to have their next child in the United States to ensure the best possible prenatal care during the pregnancy. They were eventually blessed with two children after this loss. While she couldn't remember much about the gravesite service, one thing had stuck in her mind for all these years.
What I remember most is the presence of the Congolese who came to be with us, because they all knew about the loss of the child. They just came and sat quietly by my bed. They treasured the presence of brothers and sisters in Christ.
As she explained, about 20 Congolese came to her home and sat with her and her husband for several hours. This is the concept of what I call presence, that is part of their culture as a way to offer support and relationship. Nothing needs to be said. Simply being is the support. They chose not to name the baby, who was a boy. So the moniker on the headstone is Baby Boy Berggren. Baby Boy Berggren was buried at Kala near the church, alongside the grave for Grace Joan Skoglund, who had died in 1936 at the age of 18 months. So the 14th saint was now in glory. Rest in peace, Baby Boy Berggren.
Precious in the eyes of the Lord is the death of his saints. Psalms 116:15.
After serving 5 years in Congo, the Berggrens joined Save the Children International, an organization that focuses on helping children around the world with health, hunger, education, and opportunities. They spent the remainder of their career serving there, working in Vietnam, Bangladesh, and other countries. They also were faculty members of the Harvard School of Public Health. When the evacuation occurred in 1960 due to independence, that disrupted the Ubangi Academy boarding school at Karawa. That year, school was held at Bata in the Central African Republic. But in 1961, things were back to normal and the missionaries returned to Congo. In 1962, UBOC boasted 4 teachers. In 1962, Bob and Ruth Ann Peterson arrived as dorm parents. They were in this role well into the 1980s when they retired. They were the primary dorm parents during my tenure at UBOC from 1970 through my 1980 graduation. And by 1963, there were 36 dorm attendees. Then, in 1964, due to the Simba Rebellion, the school closed again as all the missionaries evacuated. This was when our family was to have arrived, but were told to stay in the U.S. The school again moved to Bata, Central African Republic, and the school year was completed there. By summer of 1965, the mission board felt it safe enough, so the school moved back to Karawa. For the 1965 school year, our family went to Congo for the first time. I was 3 years old. My parents were the dorm parents, and my dad, Roger Eels, was one of the teachers. There were 14 students total. By 1968, the last two high school rooms were completed and the dedication was held January 10, 1968. So in total, the school had a room for grades 2 through 4, a room for grades 5 through 6, a room for 7th and 8th, a library with a classroom, and two rooms for the high schoolers. The school continued to flourish, with certain teachers spending their careers there, only returning to the U.S. for furlough. Dorothy Blakeway, Margaret Nelson, Don Erickson, Elaine Peterson, and Lucy Dobbs were there for many years, and they all overlapped my time there in the 1970s. When a regular teacher was on furlough, short-term teachers would fill in. Attendance at the dorm varied, with up to over 40 a few years, and the student count at the school over 50, as the kids living at Carowa also attended. It should be noted that they used a Minnesota curriculum and was college prep. It was hard scholastically, as they wanted to ensure success of the missionary kids when they returned to the U.S. every 3 or 4 years. I was an above-average student, but I had to work really hard to hold A's and B's, which was the expectation. But in the States, I aced every class, and school was easy. It did the job well of preparing one for college. National merit scholars abounded from our little school, and UBOC boasts many alumni with bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and PhDs. With limited resources, the teachers are to be commended for their positive impact and creativity in teaching methodologies to send their graduates on to successful educational careers. In conclusion of this fourth episode in the series, we discussed several mission station procurements, the Tandala Hospital construction, and the relocation of the Bible Institute to Goyongo. Also, the construction of the Ubangi Academy, the boarding school to educate the kids, was also completed. But there were people that gave their lives in the process: Clyde Carlson, Timothy Almquist, and Baby Boy Berggren. I was able to access considerable materials from the Free Church Archives, thanks to Dr. Tom Cairns and Dr. Tim Wester, to help put this episode together. Numerous other books and reports were read, and those acknowledgments will be in the final episode of this series. Dr. Tim Wester, Thelma Landrud, John Lundquist, and Dan Noren did a great job describing Gwenji, Tandala, Goyongo, and Bumba. And I want to thank David Lumblad, Aldi Almquist, and Dr. Gretchen Berggren. They shared the painful memories of those family members' or friends' death experience. Thanks also to the many folks who provided voiceovers for the characters in this episode to help bring more reality to the stories. In episode 5 of this 7-part series, we will present the period of 1963 to 1972 of our mission work in the northwest corner of Congo. You will hear about the country's political turmoil and the rebellion that happened in 1964, leading to another evacuation and the capture and death of Dr. Paul Carlson. Thank you for listening, and I hope you continue the journey with me and listen to the next episode of Trials and Triumphs in Congo, a 100-year mission journey. So that concludes this episode. I hope you enjoyed it and will listen again. Other podcasts and blog articles on a variety of topics can be found at congokid.net. In addition, Congo Kids' life stories are also posted on Apple iTunes, Google Podcast, and Spotify. I'm Jeff Eels, a.k.a. Congo Kid, your humble host. Until next time, I will send you off with a farewell in Lingala. Baninga nangai, tikala malamu. My friends, stay well.